Hello, and welcome to the latest edition of the Insurers the Best Policy podcast. My name is David Bull, and today I'm joined by Mike Sapner, CEO of reinsurer TransRe. In the first of this two-part interview, we discuss market dynamics in reinsurance and the underlying insurance business, and why this market is nothing like the true hard markets of the mid-1980s and 2001, despite the COVID catalyst. We also talk cheap capital, the challenges of lower for longer interest rates, and what that means for underwriting, and why reinsurance demand is not picking up as some might have hoped. And we look at the lessons from the pandemic about how the industry operates and the imperative to strip cost from the value chain. We start by asking Mike, who has been with TransRe for 25 years, whether he has ever seen a market dynamic like this on the underlying insurance business, and whether this is the real deal in terms of a hard market.
You know, it's certainly rapidly hardening, but I don't think it's even close to hard markets that I've seen in the past, specifically post-1986. I think really a hard market is when you can't find the capacity. It's not available at any price, virtually any price. And we're seeing deals get done for the most part. If you have a large casualty tower, maybe there's some capacity holes or things are shrinking. If you're starting at a very high limit, $500 million plus. But in terms of getting deals done, I think brokers feel they can get things done. It's just, is the price acceptable? In 1986, you just could not get capacity, insurance or reinsurance. There was very little capital coming in. There were insolvencies going on. All lines were affected. It wasn't limited to casualty or property. So it was fairly long and deep, hard market. I think while the insurance market is improving here, in most lines of business, it's not as robust of an improvement on the reinsurance side, right? So especially if you talk about casualty and pro rata casualty reinsurance, property cat excess might be hardening as fast as original rates, but clearly this is not all territories, all lines at the same time, reinsurance and insurance. Matter of fact, I mean, I'd say internationally, there's been quite a lag on casualty and property hard market. So now every hard market is a little bit different. I haven't seen anything with this dynamic. I think what's interesting here is you have an investment issue going on at the same time as a risk issue. So that obviously has some leveraging effects. But in terms of just insurance, hard market, I would say this still trails not just 1986, but 2001 as well.
And what do you think the difference is between those some previous hard market situations?
Well, I think the primary difference is you buy reinsurance for two reasons, capital and uncertainty, right? So I think here you have uncertainty, but you don't have capital issues. I mean, I don't see companies going under right now, and capital is as available and cheap as it's ever been. So I think people can access the capital markets. They're listening. Equity and debt markets are listening to those stories and offering capital in what seems to be fairly easy manner or sell. So I think that's a big difference where it was very difficult to find capital to get into the industry in 1986, post-2001, and to some degree post-2005 Katrina, which was, you know, a little more of a property-focused hard market. So this is not blood in the streets, holes in balance sheets type of a hard market. This is a return-based, bonus-losing, job-fearing, COVID-uncertainty hard market. That's different.
And you touched on it a bit there, and I guess, you know, the theme of the last, even if this isn't a true hard market in the same way as some of those earlier examples we used are in the underlying business. I mean, reinsurance pricing has certainly been lagging behind the underlying business and also pricing. And, you know, of course, as the market does, some of your peers are calling the sort of dawn of hardening pressures in reinsurance. I'm not going to ask if you buy into their optimism because clearly you don't, but I mean, how do you sort of see the kind of outlook as we go into sort of 2021?
Well, I think that I share their view that it's an improving market and it will stay an improving market for the next 24 to 36 months. I believe, certainly on the casualty side, property is probably maybe a little shorter than that, depending on loss activity and how much capital comes in. So on a relative basis, I'd say, yeah, we're getting into a more attractive market, a hardening market. On an absolute basis, I wouldn't call it a hard market. So I think you're getting into a market where we are being properly compensated for the risk assumed. We're not being overly compensated. So I think step one is to get back to proper compensation, and let's at least get paid for that. I think you need both, as I said before, uncertainty and kind of capital crunch to get into a true hard market. And right now we're not there. It's interesting to see people raising capital. You don't know if that is to take advantage of an improving market. You don't know if they do have holes in balance sheets or if they just think capital's so cheap, let's grab it while we can. But not all capital's the same in terms of how long you have to hold on to it, what the cost of that capital is, and what the covenants of that capital implied or explicit. So that can change people's behavior. But it's not like we're, like I said, it's not like a ton of, from a reinsurance standpoint, it's not like reinsurance deals aren't getting done. For reinsurers to be raising a lot of capital is kind of surprising to me because with the little bit of an exception in Florida, deals are getting done comfortably. Matter of fact, the brokers said it was better, easier at July 1 than it was at June 1.
Yeah.
Now, whether that continues, I'm not sure.
And let's talk a bit more about COVID-19 and how long do you expect it will take for the true picture to be really understood when it comes to industry exposure? And what does that kind of uncertainty have, do you think, for reinsurance demand going forward as people look at volatility in their earnings and
Yeah.
how to address that?
Well, let me ask you this. How much certainty do we have about asbestos right now? That's still
That's a
going
point.
on. I don't know if you'll ever know with any certainty of the full effects of COVID, because it's not just a liability issue or a loss issue. There's, first of all, if you look on the casualty side, I don't know how long workers' comp claims will extend, or healthcare issues. For example, people are deferring elective surgeries right now, right? Well, what's the definition of elective? There is some stuff where you need emergency surgery. Elective surgeries, and there's that expression that minor surgery is surgery somebody else has, right? So it could be that certain elective surgeries are elective immediately, but maybe over the long term they have to be done. And if those get delayed and there are health consequences around that, does that lead to further liability issues? The courts are closed right now. Is that deferring frequency? What happens when they reopen? Is there, how do we settle those cases? Will there be redistribution of wealth because of issues that COVID has raised? How will the credit markets respond? When will surety losses become manifest? And then I think the biggest thing is the investment environment. COVID has forced monetary easing and fiscal policy that is extremely aggressive, driving interest rates down to virtually zero or negative across the world, which has ramifications on underwriting. The bigger issue here is, does the model have to change? There is no value for the float. You have to make all of your return essentially on the underwriting side. There is no investment income to save you from the mistakes or or rainy day fund when you get reviver claims opening up or your asbestos-like suits or a pandemic loss that you didn't think you were covering or levees breaking in New Orleans. We've all been able to move through those issues historically because there's been some cushion in the investment income side. When you wake up every morning, you're leveraged 3 to 1 and you're getting 5 to 8% investment returns, that's, 15 to 24% on your ROE. Now you got expenses and all that stuff, right? Over your overhead. But that's a pretty good start. And you could argue that maybe lower interest rates lower the hurdle rate that you have because you are offering a spread above risk-free. But the problem is if your only upside is essentially underwriting profit, well, that's a finite upside, right? The most I can make is my premium, and I know I'm going to take some losses. But when I make investments, especially equity investments, there's infinite upside, right? I can make some investments that go up where the risk reward is much more attractive. So I'm not sure that even though risk-free rates are down and therefore, our hurdle rates are down, that the spread that we're going to be able to offer above risk-free rate is commensurate with the risk that we're actually taking. We take a lot of asymmetric risk where our limits are multiples of our premium, and the aggregations of those limits are multiples of that premium. And
Right.
we like to say the one, our business is not the nine good deals we write, it's the one bad deal we avoid.
Yeah.
And right now, in this environment, that one bad deal is going to cause an awful lot of relative pain because there's just not a lot of margin for error. That's probably the biggest change in COVID, of what COVID's bringing. I think risk appetites and a lot more conservatism on the balance sheet will be manifest.
And should that not be a catalyst for more reinsurance demand there? I mean,
It should be, or at least better reinsurance pricing. But
yeah.
what happens with reinsurance demand is it depends on the product line, right? If you take D&O, which is maybe an $8 to $10 billion industry, and you put that premium against the 40 D&O writers who are out there, their capital base is enormous relative to the premium. So D&O risk gets kind of diversified away, such that those buyers kind of say to themselves, well, if the choice is I could cut limits or exposure, or buy more reinsurance on what they might think are punitive terms, right now they're making the choice to write less insurance rather than buy a reinsurance quota share with a 23 ceding commission. They're saying, well, we want to buy it with a 33. And they're coming up with a walk away price because they have enough capital on the balance sheet, and because it's not, it's a claims made cover, not occurrence based, it's not aggregating, and it's a small marketplace. So their percentage of the premium relative to their overall percentage of their overall premium and their capital is tolerable. So we're just seeing a lot more of that kind of line in the sand. We'll buy at that price, and absent that, we won't buy because it's not a capital need buy. Now,
Yeah.
it is an uncertainty buy, right? But they're saying, okay, well, I'll just shrink my book rather than take a ceding commission that's below my overhead. That's a whole different, above my total cost. That's a whole different conversation around our total cost of the industry, right? Because, that gets into the fact that we only return about 55 cents on the dollar, and we have too much in expenses and overhead and admin and LAE and theoretically profit margin. We know the profit margin now has to expand. Well, where's that going to come from? Got to come from significantly more rate, which means you're returning less percentage of your dollar to the customer, or it's got to come from cutting costs. And if you're returning less to the customer in terms of claims on a percentage basis, your value goes down, your value proposition goes down, your ability to sell insurance goes down, the likelihood of substitute products goes up. That's not good for the industry either. There's a lot to unpack in all that, but that's
Yeah.
an interesting issue.
Well, I was going to ask you later actually about the kind of impact of COVID-19 and the way as an industry we've had to adjust our working practices. And I mean, to jump into that now and talking about the cost issue, I mean, how much of a lesson is this or the ability to find more efficient ways to do business in the sector.
Well, I think it's a big lesson. If you look at, for us, I mean, I think 80% of our costs are people. It's not really travel and entertainment. That's probably bigger for the brokers. It's not really overhead in terms of real estate. So, you know, I think that yes, we can travel less and save a couple bucks, and our expense ratio might go down 25 basis points. The issue is, I hate to say this, is but you know, what will artificial intelligence do? What will process and efficiencies do to drive down the cost of human capital in our business? Right? I look at the business as commoditized business and idiosyncratic business. And too much of our commoditized business is still touched a lot. And it's touched a lot by people, and it's touched a lot by organizations. If you're buying a property policy, homeowners or commercial, and you go to an MGA or an agent who then goes to an insurance company, who then goes to, or you go through an insurance broker to an MGA to an insurance company to a reinsurance broker to a reinsurance company to a retro broker or a capital market or a retrocessionaire. That's too many people adding the cost, too many organizations, too much in the chain. How do you take business that is somewhat commoditized and take not just organizations out of that chain, but people in those organizations out of the physical processing? I think that's got to happen. Idiosyncratic risks, whether it's D&O to some degree, although I could argue that could be a lot more automated, medical malpractice, some credit insurance, reps and warranties covers, certain GL lines of business, you know, certain complex property accounts, that all is going to need a lot of interaction, discussion, risk management, risk analysis, and underwriting, and is not necessarily suitable for broad-based metrics and commoditization. I think the industry really needs to split that, and probably needs to split it not just on people, but on balance sheets. And maybe that commoditized risk that is running through a balance sheet but finding its way to deeper capital should be willing to take A minus paper or A paper or less capital, and more idiosyncratic should demand a higher balance sheet. So when you're talking to just people's lives, I mean, I had a conversation this morning with our CFO. We're just saying, you know, maybe we just draw a line in the sand on commit to how many days a week you want to be in the office or how many days a year, and say, okay, if you are over that in a year, you will have dedicated workspace. And if you're under that, you'll have flex workspace. And you can work from wherever, right? And that probably allows us to skinny down real estate expenses and cost of office furniture and maximize efficiencies. But, you know, on the reinsurance side, those are going to be smaller issues as opposed to the actual people. We're only 650 people worldwide, so it's not like, you know, the labor leverage in reinsurance is already pretty good in terms of people. The costs are expensive, though.
Well, thanks, Mike, and thanks to all of you for listening. In the next episode, which will air later this week, we talk property cat and the impact of what's happening in the ILS market, as well as strategic capital relationships. Mike gives his view on the insurability of pandemics, public-private solutions, and the read across from COVID-19 to systemic cyber exposures. And we talk about the industry's diversity issue and just how companies can address it.